funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can the study of all the world's living things tell us about the prospects for the survival of the Earth and of the human race? In a scientific career that spans six decades, E.O. Wilson has focused much of his research on a creature all too often dismissed as simply a nuisance, the ant. But his interest in myrmecology has led him to a number of fascinating and sometimes controversial conclusions, not least of which is the idea that the selections of evolution may actually take place at the group rather than individual level, meaning there is a biological basis for altruism and morality. These days, he is a passionate champion of an ever-growing online database called the Encyclopedia of Life, which seeks to put information about every kind of organism on the planet in a place where anybody, scientist or layperson, can learn from and contribute to the body of knowledge. E.O. Wilson is Pellegrino University Research Professor in Entomology for the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology at Harvard and a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He's in town to receive the 2009 International Award of Excellence in Conservation from the Botanical Research Institute of Texas. Ed, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about the Encyclopedia of Life. Talk about what it is and how it's coming together.
It's a very simple idea, but it took a long time coming because it depended upon the full emergence of the digital age. And it is very simply an encyclopedia that is electronic, that has one page for every species of plant, animal, and microorganism in the world, and everything on that page known about it. And it's open source, although it is vetted by experts so that information coming in has to be cleared by them and certified before it's then released through the encyclopedia, and therefore it is not a typical wiki. It's not a Wikipedia. It's launched, and in time we expect to have a million of the 1.8 million species of organisms known on Earth online this way within a couple of years. And it's being pursued or being administered by the Smithsonian Institution, which is its headquarters, and a number of organizations around the world, a growing number. In time, everything known about every kind of creature on Earth will be immediately available, anyone, anywhere, anytime, free.
And ultimately, I suppose the goal is to start to see similarities and confluences between different organisms that may not have been apparent before.
Actually, 10% possibly of the organisms of the Earth, the species, the different kind, are known only 10%, roughly, in that area, with the vast majority of small invertebrate animals, including insects, still undiscovered by science. Even really small percentage of the plants of Earth have been discovered. Something like 60,000 kinds of fungi are known, but there are over 1.5 million of those. So the vast majority are unknown. We need a platform of knowledge on which to build the exploration of what most would agree is a little-known planet. And we need to know what's out there. We need to know what these how these organisms are adapted to their environment, what they might have of use to humanity in the way of new pharmaceuticals, new products. We need to know how they're acting to hold the environment together for our benefit. We need to know which ones are going extinct and stop it. Managing the environment in a scientific and more precise way than we have up till this time. And to save the biosphere in which we were born. It's an essential part of managing the living environment and therefore the environment as a whole. So this is going to be one of the major developments of biology in the decades ahead, the Encyclopedia of Life.
How fast are we losing biodiversity right now?
About 1,000 times faster than we were losing it before people came along.
That's a terrifying number.
Well, it is. And it means that at this rate, unless we find a way to abate it, It's exacerbated, made worse by the climate change that's underway. Unless we can do something serious about it, we could lose half the species of plants and animals on the planet in the next century.
Are we victims, Ed, of our own success in adapting the planet so that it's comfortable for human beings?
Well, maybe it's comfortable in some places on the short term. And yes, we've changed it. We've changed the world in an attempt to produce more people by clearing more and more land and producing more and more food and producing more and more people. But this is not necessarily making the planet more comfortable or even more habitable in the long term, because we now are seeing the consequences of consuming too much too fast, of converting too many of the natural environments to agricultural output, industrial output, you know, and for the creation of what we call the ecological footprint, all the lands needed to sustain our lifestyle. And so doing, we're making this planet less stable. We're running serious shortages. Water is the critical one right now. We have to make major adjustments just to keep up. And those major adjustments are not necessarily going to be making life more pleasant for us. We need to be doing long-term planning so as to save the rest of life and as much of the natural environment around us, because the natural environment has been providing us with services, taking care, you know, renewing the soil, managing the water for us, maintaining the atmosphere, roughly equal, it's been estimated, to all of our productivity if you can measure it in dollars. And they've been giving it to us scot-free. If we destroy it, as we destroy it, we're throwing away the best deal that humanity ever had, that is the comfort and the security that the rest of life provides us.
Well, you mentioned that we've changed our environment, sort of trying to create more people. I wonder if there's an extent to which we have to fight against a sort of evolutionary imperative to create more human beings in order to allow future generations of human beings to exist.
That's exactly right. Because for untold millennia, the human species first managed to hold on to its own survival, that is, individuals and their families were the units holding on to their own survival. And then after that, as we learned through the technological breakthroughs that began with the old Stone Age and then accelerated with the discovery of agriculture about 10,000 years ago, we discovered that we could consume more and produce bigger families and spread people more rapidly, and that this gave us individual security that was much improved over the old. With that having happened throughout the history of humanity, it's not surprising perhaps to find that we have a powerful instinct, not just to survive, but essentially to reproduce ourselves and do whatever it takes to reproduce ourselves. But we are approaching the limit, and actually we are approaching the turnaround point in the human population. Fertility rates are declining on every continent now, and the result is that we will come to an all-round zero population growth and begin to decline, that has reached the peak of population in this century, probably toward the end of it. The estimates now are about at 9 billion people or a few more. That's 40% more people than we have now. Then it'll begin to come down. So what we need to be doing is preparing the environment, preparing ourselves for a time when we're putting less pressure by numbers alone on the environment. And we should be trying to make safe the rest of life and the natural environment that surrounds us. I am certain that if we can do these things, and we can do them sensibly and correct, that the 22nd century will be a paradise on earth for humanity.
How serious is the problem, though, that most human beings are sort of wired to think about their kids, maybe their grandkids, and then figure that all the rest of that is somebody else's problem?
That's right. We are programmed. The brain is hardwired to think about our family, our closest neighbors, maybe our kin network, and not much else. We're programmed for survival and reproduction. That's maximized that way. And we're programmed to not worry too much about beyond the grandchildren or great-grandchildren range. So we are hereditarily short-visioned, but we're the first species in history to have a sense of history and to know what long-term amounts to and to care about people beyond our immediate circle and to care about generations beyond three or four down the line. That in mind, and with the confluence of serious science-based planning and of the participation of the religions of the world that have this as a precept that we are to save humanity and the creation, I think we can actually change to a worldview, an ethic in which we plan for the very long term as opposed to just our immediate needs.
E.O. Wilson is my guest. He's in town to receive the 2009 International Award of Excellence in Conservation from the Botanical Research Institute of Texas. We'll resume our conversation with Ed in just a moment, and you're welcome to get on the line right now to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. We are also still in the midst of our spring membership campaign. I am joined to that end by Jeff Whittington, senior producer of this show, also host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I've got to say, what a fascinating conversation. And if we've gotten close to the you're not going to call and join the station because you're listening and you're completely enthralled by a guest earlier in the week, we're definitely there.
But you've got
this hour.
3 minutes now where just Jeff and I are talking.
That's right.
Giving it a break for a minute.
800-456-5372, online at kera.org. Chris, I have to say, and I want to say it on the air, that Professor Wilson has been someone who I've wanted to get on the show for a long time. And in the past, he's been too busy to join us remotely, and it paid off because he's in town. He's sitting right here in the studio, and I'm so excited. If you're excited that we're able to get Dr. Wilson on the show today, please call and support the station and support the show, 800-456-5372, online at kera.org.
We have $193,247 left to raise, and then we are finished. The way we budget things around here is we figure out exactly how much money we're going to need. We program that into three different fundraising drives throughout the year, and then we just raise money until we have what we need. We're not trying to get rich here. We're just trying to raise the money that is required to bring you the programming that you count on. I can guarantee you this is not a conversation that we would be able to bring you if we worked at any other radio station in this market. Not to say there's anything wrong with those other places, but here we have the luxury of having an hour, which with Dr. Wilson is not nearly enough, but it's still a wonderful amount of time to have to be able to explore things in depth. And that is what you're paying for when you support KERA at 1-800-456-5372.
We heard from Terry Raley in Keller. We heard from Carol Flanagan in Frisco. Thanks so much to John Lowe in Dallas and Vicki Nickerson in Dallas. Also, we heard from Melissa Wise in Dallas and Kent Garcia in Dallas. Thanks so much to each of you. We're gonna get this done. We're going to close this out by, I'm thinking we can do it by the end of the day tomorrow, but only if you call 800-456-5372, only if you go online to kera.org and make a contribution.
We have lots of great ways to say thanks. You can talk to the person on the phone when you make the call, or you can check it out online. You can pay with a credit card or a debit card. You can set up a sustaining membership. You can even send a paper check if you prefer. Just please give us a call at 1-800-456-5372 or go to kera.org. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is two-time Pulitzer Prize winner E.O. Wilson, who is in town to receive the 2009 International Award of Excellence in Conservation from the Botanical Research Institute of Texas. If you would like to join our conversation, we welcome you to call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You believe that human beings are genetically wired to want and need religion. Can you talk about the benefits that it confers?
I think it's pretty clear that we're genetically wired to be predisposed to learn that. Psychologists have, and to become committed, psychologists have a term that fits it very well. It's called prepared learning and counter-prepared learning. In other words, what we're hardwired for is not, you know, to pick up some specific creed or belief system, but rather to pick up a creed or belief system. And we learn certain things very easily, prepared. We learn certain things only with great difficulty or more inclined to learn not to do them or believe them. That's counter-prepared. It has been of enormous benefit to humanity to have a religion in the past because of benefits at several levels. One is at the group level, that those who are united by a common belief are likely to be willing to be sacrificial on behalf of the group and altruistic toward each other. That's well established. And that gives the group as a whole an advantage over other groups that are rent by cheaters, by people who don't agree with others in the group. And when the time of crisis comes and during shortages or the approach of enemy, then it is the united group, the one that believe that they are guided by a divine presence, who win. But then, in addition, clearly, religions give us a sense of comfort, because we're the, in times of personal crisis, because we are the only species ever, so far as we know, to understand our own personal mortality.
Do you think, then, that there's a possibility that we will evolve beyond a need for religion and satisfy ourselves with secular forms of community?
Only if we have an adequate substitute for the satisfactions that religion give us so conveniently. And that's, of course, one of the great problems of philosophy, of human psychological adjustments that people have to make. It's one of the great problems facing those who would like to have a more purely secular environment. How can we find in the secular movement, that essentially non-believers' culture, the equivalent of a Roman Catholic high funeral mass? You cannot compete with the poetry.
The grandeur.
The grandeur. The conviction and the feeling of awe that proceeds so quickly from a belief that you are in the presence of a divinity. And that's what religions have supplied, and they have reinforced with magnificent cultural outgrowth, intended to reinforce it.
Although you're not, strictly speaking, a believer in God yourself, you say there's no point in dismissing the influence of religion. And in fact, you think the ideal situation would be that people who are secular and look at the world from a scientific point of view come a little bit closer to respecting the spirituality of people who do believe.
What we have in common is that key word you just used, spirituality. In other words, secularists who have a sufficient understanding of the environment, of human history, and of the very nature of the productions of our culture that are most powerful in evoking our emotions, are quite capable of having an equal spirituality to that of the completely convinced believer in a particular faith.
Do you think that it's more of a challenge for people who are believers in faith to come a little bit closer to looking at the world from a scientific viewpoint?
I believe the only thing we can do, and it's something that I tried to put into practice recently in my book, The Creation, is to put aside deliberately in our conversations across faith, and, you know, from the secularist to the strongly religious, put them aside and address ourselves as allies on what can be called transcendent issues and problems. The transcendent one that I selected was, I'm totally involved in and committed to, the saving of the rest of life. That is the diversity, species, ecosystems of the rest of life. And it occurred to me that we need not only the scientific information, we need not only the commitment of secularists who have studied the whole issue and can see far enough into the future as to what the consequences will be of destroying much of the rest of life are. But we need the authentic passion and commitment of religious people because that transcends itself, simple economic and selfish interest.
Do you think that our individual drive to survive is less powerful from an evolutionary perspective than our drive to survive as a group?
I don't think those have ever been measured. I think they're intertwined completely.
Can they be measured? Maybe not.
Well, perhaps, although I don't think that exact tests have been made. They might be able to be made by, standard type of psychological test. But there's no question that the group solidarity and the belief that the group is favored by God and that their actions of altruism and sacrifice are smiled upon by a force and an entity superior to anything human. When you believe that, then you would be inclined to sacrifice your life rather readily. However, that's true of secularists too. Mm-hmm. It's the band of brothers phenomenon that in combat, men, I guess ladies would too, if they were in combat situations like that, have repeatedly shown they're willing on the spot to commit their lives, even knowingly sacrifice their lives. That's why we give the Congressional Medal of Honor. We give it to the man who throws himself on the grenade to save the men around him, or who deliberately rushes into enemy fire knowing that he'll go down, but not before he's able to drag a wounded comrade back. This is the kind of heroism that we all are enormously affected by and proud of. And I think that comes independent of religion. I think it comes from an intensity of bonding among members of a group in a stressful situation.
I want to go back for a minute to your study of ants. You famously said, and I'll paraphrase here, I hope close to correctly, that Karl Marx was right. He just had the wrong species.
Yes, ants have shown that communism works. And it is that people often ask me that, you can find King Solomon recommending ants as a paradigm of human behavior and morality, but nothing could be more wrong because just to cite a couple of differences that may make ants less attractive to us, all ants are female. That is, all the ones you see in the colony of ants, they're all ladies. Now, I'm a liberal, but I think it would be carrying liberalism. That would be liberalism run amok.
We need men, too. Yeah.
If you propose that you dispose of men or you just keep them around for a brief breeding season. But there are other things, too. Ant colonies are always at war. Most species, they're always fighting and one colony will wipe out another colony of the same species given half a chance. That's not anything I think we'd want to continue to to emulate.
And they send their old women, essentially, out to fight the battles.
Well, yes. As it turns out, since the warriors are all female, and something we've discovered that generally it's only older workers, those ants are perfectly altruistic, right? You must understand. They stop breeding. They let the queen do the breeding. And they also are sacrificial with a sweep of an antenna. And older individuals are the ones who are most ready to sacrifice themselves. It's kind of a calculus that as you get older, you are more likely to become infirm and you're not as good as nursing or building the nest and so on. So older ants are the ones that patrol. They go out on expeditions looking for food, and they are the first to go out in battle. So I've just often said the real difference between ants and people is that whereas we send our young men to war, they send their old ladies.
We have an email here from Bill who says, assuming you're correct about how high the human population will get before it reverses direction, how do we avoid an Easter Island scenario of wiping out all our natural resources and ocean life so that these things can remain viable beyond that point?
Yeah, I think the example of Easter Island is a serious warning to us. But on the other hand, that was an island of a population on an island that was truly isolated. And it went over the line before it realized where it was. Whereas the human population as a whole is still well short of that line. And I believe that now the new environment movement, which is turning the human population green, pastel green, but still green and going in the right direction, is capable of waking up as to what the problem, what the peril really is, and I think we can stop short. I'm an optimist in that respect.
E.O. Wilson is my guest. He's Pellegrino University Research Professor in Entomology for the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology at Harvard. We'll be back to our conversation with him in just a moment. And if you'd like to join us, you're welcome to send an email to think@kera.org or to call 1-800-933-5372. Right now, we would ask that you think about making a contribution to public radio to keep discussions like this on the air, to keep great programming and the in-depth discussion of ideas in a respectful environment, strong and vibrant in your community. The way you do that is by sending a little money, or a lot of money if you're so inclined, to 1-800-456-5372. You can also do this online at kera.org. Joined once again by Jeff Whittington. Hey, Jeff, how are we doing?
We're doing well. We've heard from several people, including Christina Duncan in Dallas, Mr. and Mrs. John Herber in Dallas, Cleo Patrick in Dallas. Cleo wanted us to know, by the way, that she canceled her satellite radio subscription so that she could, so she would have the budget to become a sustaining member of KERA.
Thank you, Cleo.
So thank you so much, Cleo. Joshua Huff in Fort Worth. Thanks to everybody. Annette Brown in Dallas, Christine Stanton in Dallas, Lori Westbrooks in Richardson, and Sharon McCombs in Crescent. And also Reverend Olin Knudsen in Dallas. Thank you so much for making your contribution. 800-456-5372, online at kera.org. That's a safe, secure place that you can make a contribution. And we're hearing from a lot of people, Chris, since this morning, because now that we're below the psychological $200,000 left to raise barrier, we could really knock this thing out by the end of the day tomorrow.
There might be some evolutionary explanation for why we wait until we think we're past the halfway point to really pick up on this. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why, because we've said it during the show. If everybody who has pledged this week pledged last week, or if you're going to pledge, if you pledged last week, we'd be done. Because we would have raised the $600,000 necessary to keep the station going, and it'd be over. But there's some sort of psychological trigger.
It might be masochism, actually. You just want to sit through the fundraising drive and keep it that much longer. Do us all a favor, and if you can find it in your heart to make a contribution, make the call now. to 1-800-456-5372. You can also go online to kera.org. You know, Jeff, I was thinking about this today. My family, we have memberships to a lot of places around town. We belong to like the Arboretum and the Art Museum. We've had memberships to the zoo before. And the way those work is that if you just want to go one time, then you pay an admission price and you go in. And then if you decide you're going to go more than one time, then, you know, you get this membership and it's a little bit less expensive and all that. I suppose if there were some mechanism, public radio could work that way, that we could say, well, if you just want to listen this one time, you know, send a dollar or swipe your card or something. But we can't do it that way. So the reason that we ask you for a membership is that essentially we sort of allowed you in the first time for free, letting you see if you liked it, letting you see if it meant enough to you to come back. You come back every day. So get the full membership and don't just sort of rely on the free gimme. Just become a member.
1-800-456-5372. Online at kera.org. A lot of folks to thank you. By the way, from what I can tell, from what I've deduced from these numbers that are written and crossed out, I think we're at about $192,600 left to go in the drive. So your contribution right now at any level, but especially if you've been considering giving at a higher level, you know, you've been thinking about it, you've been listening for almost 2 weeks to the membership campaign, and you're thinking, gosh, I could do a $3,000 gift, or I could do a $5,000 gift. Now, this is a leadership gift. This is really the kind of contribution to the station that is, you know, really inspirational to all the listeners. And of course, anyone who gives at any level has our gratitude, our appreciation, because it's really all about participating. But at this point, we also want to knock as much of this goal down as fast as we possibly can, because we know that there are those of you who are going to wait no matter what until we get to the $170,000 left to raise, or $120,000, or $50,000 left to raise to call. So if you have considered giving at a higher level, this would be a great day to do it at 800-456-5372 or online at kera.org. And, you know, Chris, it also, when you give a little more, it helps to cover somebody who maybe can't afford to give at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, public radio belongs to the community. We're here to serve the community. We honestly wish that we could do it for free, but we have expenses here that we have to pay. We have salaries. We have to pay for programming that comes in from the network. We do that to serve you. And we just ask that if you can find it in your heart to recognize that this is not a free service, that this is a service that has costs, that we all listen to it, and therefore we all defray the expenses together. And I will say that most of the staff here are members, even though it's not a requirement, because it's something that we believe in personally. Give us a call right now at 1-800-456-5372. Let us know you value the service and you want it to continue. You can also go online and make a contribution on our website. That's at kera.org. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is E.O. Wilson, who is a 2-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and is in town to accept the 2009 International Award of Excellence in Conservation from the Botanical Research Institute of Texas. If you'd like to join our conversation, we welcome you to call 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Reeves in Dallas. Hey, Reeves.
Hi. I want to say that Professor Wilson is one of my idols, and I also have a sort of a two-part question. I wanted to know how individuals in the communities can promote biodiversity in their gardens. We personally have a xeriscape garden. And the other issue is that of invasive species. I bought something at a toy store, and it thought I was getting a praying mantis kit, right? And it turns out it's Asian praying mantises that eat hummingbirds. So, you know, if he could kind of address this, because I noticed in the community that I live in, of University Park, everybody uses these long crews that kind of obliterate a lot of the biodiversity in their techniques and fertilization process.
Great questions. Thanks, Reeves.
First of all, gardeners can be among the most powerful conservationists in society because plants, of course, including endangered species, can be cultivated. whereas I don't think many of us would like to help save the Indian tiger or the Tasmanian devil. It'd be hard, technically. But for heaven's sake, we can plant and cultivate and keep. They make wonderful conversational topics. Some of the most endangered species of plants in the world. And in fact, things like Bartram's beautiful flowering plant that went extinct shortly after it was, the first ones were collected in the 1700s, survives and flourishes in gardens today, as does the torreya, the little conifer that has essentially gone extinct due to fungus disease but survives and so on. The possibilities are infinite. I'd really love to hear more and more botanists and gardeners describe how they keep species going alive by planting some of these often beautiful species of plant. And far as invasive species, well, it's true that that's the invasive species. Invasive, incidentally, is officially defined as a species that's alien and harms either humans or the environment. And that element has become the second biggest destroyer of environments worldwide, next to habitat destruction. And the number of invasive species coming in, pouring into the United States and countries elsewhere around the world, is going up faster and faster. We don't seem to be able to put a stop to it. And I don't have any solid recommendations to do for individuals, except check out your praying mantis the next time before you buy it.
I guess you'll have to look that up online and make sure you're getting exactly what they've told you you're getting. We have an email here from Sam in Weatherford who wants to know whether our technological advances tend to hinder or help attempts to convert to conserve biodiversity.
Help. Mm-hmm. The Encyclopedia of Life, you know, which we started our program with, is an example. It allows us to find out, and this will get better and better as we go along, which species, for example, are native and which are invasive, and to find out details about them all that allows us to combat the wrong ones and aid the best ones, and further to make everyone more aware of just how valuable and priceless are each of these species in turn. I think one of the greatest problems we face right now in terms of saving biodiversity on Earth and all those endangered species out there that are winking out one by one is lack of public attention. And that's due, in fact, in return to lack of knowledge. I'd love to see more and more programs devoted to some of the fascinating cases of endangered species, their importance, their rescue by heroic efforts in different parts of the world. And more public attention can really pay off in terms of effort behind the conservation movement.
We have an email here from Mark who says, my father-in-law, who is also a longtime resident of Lexington, Massachusetts, likes to tell a story of a conversation with you in which you found an ant in your house. In the story, you get ever closer to inspect the ant, carefully monitoring its behavior, only to then squash it with your toe. And he says he finds it an endearing and humanizing story about you. I guess if you see an ant, you don't necessarily scoop it up and build it a new house. If you find one in your kitchen, you'll squash it too.
Very likely, although I like to say that by and large, appreciate that you're able to do that, because actually the ant is a sterile member. Almost certainly is not a member of an endangered species or anything like that. In any case, what I'd like to say is that to make a little bit of, you know, a humor out of this, but with some kernel of feeling behind it, if you have, in response to the question I most often ask, what do I do about the ants in my kitchen? It is watch where you step, be careful of little lives. Feed them bits of honey and tuna That those are favorite foods, and then get close to them and watch what happens. And the more you can watch them, the more you will see life so different from our own that it might well have been on another planet.
You've said before that human beings are evolved not only physically but psychologically to thrive on Earth. Does that tell you that we will never successfully colonize another planet?
I believe it tells you exactly that. I think we've gone about as far as we should go in trying to put human beings into space, out of Earth's environment. It's enormously expensive. It's it does not help health. At all. It does not add much to knowledge. As we go to improve robotics and the possibilities of robotic probes to distant and planets with which we might be able to reach within a few scores of years, for example, once we've targeted one, as we improve our optical astronomy and get to know more about rock planets that are on other star systems and could be Earth-like, and we can find out a lot about their chemistry at that distance. I believe we will satisfy the craving we have to know about other planets and other forms of life on other planets and gradually become more satisfied with this one that we have, to which we are exquisitely well adapted. We can find happiness here at home and infinite things to do that are productive and good for humanity. And I suspect that the reason why E.T. has not made it to Earth, even though it's had billions of years to do so, we haven't had alien visitors, is that when and if intelligent life has originated on other star systems, they came to that conclusion.
They were better off where they started.
Yeah, and they could learn really so much more through advanced technology and science that, at a level we haven't even begun to conceive yet, about what life must be like, where it might be, and so on, so much that it just renders those probes that would take, you know, that may be 100 light years away, it just renders them less interesting.
Can we survive here indefinitely?
Indefinitely, yes.
The last thing I want to ask you about is I understand that you've been writing a novel. Is it complete?
Yes, it's in final draft, and I hope it'll be out next May as scheduled, and it's all the title is Ant Hill. What else? It's actually centered on it's my southern novel. You know, I'm from Alabama,
yeah,
and I've recreated the transition of a family from Old South to New South, and this time, whereas Harper Lee had centered her novel on the great crisis of the South around 1960, which was civil liberties and the fight for civil rights, I've decided to center this on the fight developing and the struggles and all of the drama that go around proper management of the land. That's the big problem in the South today. They haven't come to grips with how to take care of the land, from water to natural forest to anything else. And that might sound like a considerably less interesting or dramatic venue.
Oh, it's an epic
or a novel.
Struggle.
Nonetheless, I think that people, as we go along, people will come to realize that this is where the drama is.
Well, it's been a real pleasure and an honor to have you here. Thank you so much.
I thank you.
E.O. Wilson is in town to receive the 2009 International Award of Excellence in Conservation from the Botanical Research Institute of Texas. We are proud to have been able to bring you this conversation, and now we come to you humbly and ask if you will help us stay on the air and keep this kind of great programming and discussion available to you in North Texas and to all of your neighbors. Our telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. You can also make your contribution at kera.org. KERA.org. There are times occasionally when Jeff and I both become starstruck, and this is one of those days, I think. We were both very excited about having Ed Wilson here, and it was a great conversation, and we hope that you enjoyed it. We had lots of email from those of you who did. If you emailed and said, I love the show, and it's time to renew your membership, this would be a perfect time to do it. Let us know how much you like the program.
800-456-5372. Online at KERA.org. We did hear from Frederica Phillips in Plano, Ara Whitcomb in Burleson. Listen to this diversity of locations, Chris. Thelma O'Carey in Grand Prairie, Megan Fahn in Dallas, Katie Beal in Arlington, Martha Deacon in Dallas, Catherine Sames in Allen, Parthena Archuleta in Grand Prairie, Jennifer Phillips in Roy City, also Elizabeth Smathers in McKinney, Michael Hester in Midlothian, Barry Clunder in Hazlitt, Mary Glade in Fort Worth, Ian Thorburn in Dallas, and thank you also to Dr. Michael E. Noyes in Mansfield and Rebecca Weissman in Fort Worth.
Thanks to all of you. Thanks to those of you who are on the phone right now. Our number is 1-800-456-5372. You can make a contribution in any amount. If you are in a position to be, as Jeff called it, a leadership giver, someone at the friends level or above of $1,500, we would welcome that. But if you want to do $5 or $10 or $20 a month on a sustaining membership, we welcome that as well, because it takes every little amount that we all can give based on our ability to do so to keep KERA strong and healthy in the community. Again, our number is 1-800-456-5372, or you can go to KERA.org. You will be supporting your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and online at KERA.org.
Everyone, don't forget, if you call, if you go online, you can be entered to win a trip to London to tour the BBC studios. What a fantastic opportunity to see where they make BBC radio that's heard all over the world. And this is actually a fantastic getaway. Someone, especially if you're a public radio fan and you like the BBC, you'll fly round trip nonstop on British Airways business class, and you'll get a $1,000 Marriott gift card. And as I said, it's a trip to tour the BBC studios in London. What a great deal. Somebody's going to win this. We're going to announce the winner at the end of the membership drive. We're in the 190s right now left to raise, 190,000 or so. So please call now, 800-456-5372, or go online to KERA.org and make your contribution.
We know from the responses we have when we do shows on a variety of issues that those of you who listen to the station have a lot of passions. There are things that you care deeply about and that you have committed your time and your money and your efforts to. Please consider that no matter what your passion is, if you are a public radio listener and if this is something that contributes to what you know about the world, then this is one of your passions as well. And we think well worth the investment that you make. And we do call it an investment in this kind of radio. You know, we learn more and more about people who are philanthropic givers at every level. And the big trend now is people want to feel like they are investing in something that continues to grow, kind of, you know, teaching a man to fish instead of giving a man a fish. And when you invest in public radio, that's exactly what you do. We continue to create programming. This is something that serves the broad community and also serves you as an individual. You are a beneficiary of this not-for-profit organization. So we think that it's worth making a contribution at 1-800-456-5372.
I think you're talking about targeted philanthropy.
Targeted philanthropy. That's the special, not very interesting buzz phrase.
Well, and you know what? It is a trend, and I think that organizations like museums and universities and foundations who are allowing major donors to do, you know, a big gift, like $1 million gift, and say, use this money for this, I think they're taking a page from public radio, Chris, because for decades we have gone to you and said, look, you can tell exactly where your money's going to be spent. It's not going to go to anything else except to deliver this service. That's what it's all about. That's why we're asking you to call 800-456-5372. You have a chance to support your favorite show. You know, you can support all the programs. You can select a thank you gift. You can choose how you want to pay for your membership contribution, what method of payment you want to use. But, you know that you're supporting public radio that you hear right here in Texas, where the decisions are made with you in mind every single day.
This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, K261 CW 100.1 in Tyler, K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman.
And no matter where you listen, you're getting public radio, you're getting KERA, you're getting the Think program that you hear every day, Monday through Thursday, right here at noon to 2. And we'd love for you to call now, 800-456-5372. We'd love for you to go online to KERA.org and make your contribution. We've heard from all over the North Texas area today. We are counting down to the end of the drive, about $192,000 left to raise, Chris.
Everybody loves that last, you know, $20,000 or $50,000, that part of the countdown, but the truth is we can't get there until we hear from you. We will get to that place when people call and get us there. So give us a call right now, 1-800-456-5372, or make a contribution online at KERA.org. Thanks.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.